PD Pods present the PD Podscast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 16 of the PD Podscast, hosted by me, Pranit Budev, consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon from England. I'm absolutely delighted to have Dr. Jennifer Weiss, otherwise known on ortho Twitter as at my mom the surgeon, with us as our guest today. She's a PD pod and a sports medicine surgeon in the Kaiser Permanente healthcare system and the assistant chief of the LA Medical Center. She's also chair of communications for the AAOS, sits on the diversity committee of PRISM, which is the Pediatric Research into Sports Medicine, and a staunch advocate for physician wellness sitting on the POSNA task force. I was able to meet her and listen to her speak at IPOS, which was in Florida back in 2015, speaking about the healthy mind and body for maximum performance. And with the current onslaught of the COVID pandemic and its effect on all of our lives around the world, I thought this was an amazing opportunity to sit and explore this region once again. Dr. Weiss, thank you so much for speaking to me and making a time with our 8-hour time difference.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to start off by letting the audience know that you also have a podcast. I think podcasts have grown exponentially over the past year, and that's called the Grand Rounds podcast that you do with your sister. Tell me a bit about it.
Yeah, thank you for asking. This has been a passion project. My sister and I lived in close proximity in Los Angeles for a few years, and then she had the nerve to up and move to Portland, Oregon. And while she was in Los Angeles, she was bothering me saying, we have to do a podcast, and I was kind of blowing her off. And then she moved and I made her do it because I missed her so much. And my sister is, she's an author and teacher of mindfulness. And one of her her venues is she's taught for many years at the School of Business at Stanford. And the two of us, it took a pandemic to bring us together. And what we have been focusing on is purpose in a pandemic. Some of our guests have been Joan Halifax, Roshi Joan Halifax, who is a wonderful guru, Zen Buddhist monk, who is kind of the grandmother of death and dying work. Another is Father Gregory Boyle. We've been really blessed to have a great podcast, and now you've been tagged. We're going to have to invite you too.
Fantastic. Good. Well, look, it sounds like both you and your sister extremely high flyers in what you've done. Tell me a bit about your family background and what led you into medicine and orthopedics, whilst obviously your sister's gone down a different avenue.
So the short answer is my dad was an orthopedic surgeon. When I was very young, that's always what I wanted to do. And then I bucked it for quite a while. I decided I would be a doctor, but certainly not a surgeon. Then I'll be a surgeon, but certainly not an orthopedist. And then I did my elective in pediatric orthopedics with Dr. David Roy, who now is in China, but was at Columbia for many years, and just fell in love with the world and with the world of orthopedics. My home was one which valued education above all else. Although my father was the orthopedic surgeon, I was very close to him. My mother is the staunch academic and kind of the hoister of all things education. And she is not quietly proud of her kids. And she's funny because her favorite thing is to sort of advise anybody who will listen on parenting. And it's pretty interesting because my friends do actually really love to listen to her because I think she did an okay job.
It sounds like she needs to be a guest on your podcast as well at some point, I'm sure.
Oh my gosh. And we talk about her all the time and she listens to it and is, you know, her head grows 3 sizes every time.
Tell me a bit about your medical school training and then where you went for residency, how that was and sort of shaped your career. And ultimately, we'll talk about fellowships because I really feel like that's the part of our training that cements our passion for what we do.
Absolutely. So I had kind of an interesting introduction to medical school in that I applied through a program. I went to a liberal arts school in Massachusetts called Williams College, and Mount Sinai School of Medicine at that time, and actually until last year, had a program called Humanities in Medicine, in which they recruited students who were not majoring in sciences, so the humanities. And what they did was they recruited us, and they thought, we are going to form this really great cohort of primary care physicians who have good communication skills. What was interesting is what they got was, I think, a great cohort of people, but very few of us became primary care physicians. Most of us went into surgical subspecialties. And when I look back at the strengths that we garnered in our undergraduate studies of, mine was art history, in fact, I think that a lot of us were very tangible and had these skill sets that probably lent themselves better to surgery than anything else. Anyway, flash forward, that my medical school was in New York City at Mount Sinai. I had grown up in New Jersey. I went to do my residency at Baylor in Houston, Texas, mostly in an effort to get out from under my dad's shadow, because he was mentally a huge man and a bit of an influence on the East Coast, and physically he was 6'6", and he was just this big personality, and I thought, let me go a little further away. So did my residency in Houston, and then my fellowship at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. And Vern Tolo is just a grandfather to orthopedics in a way that brings tears to my eyes, quite frankly. When I had committed to the fellowship, as we do in the U.S. About 2 years before we go, so we commit at the beginning of our fourth year, and or midway through our fourth year, and I had committed to the fellowship, and my residency at Baylor, I got so much out of it, but it was not a diverse residency. I was one of, while I was there, there was one woman that graduated when I started and one woman that came up behind me, very close with both of them. They're incredible people. There were two people of color the whole time. Like, it was not a diverse place. And I went to, and one of the conversations that I had very early on in residency was when I was an intern, and it was in the days that our internship was not in orthopedics, it was in general surgery. And it was a 36 hours of working and maybe 10 hours of rest before you started that next day. And I was post-call and groggy, but I saw that there was a scoliosis case going on. And a very senior surgeon was doing a scoli case. And I looked at one of the OR nurses, and I said, do you think you could sneak me in there? I'd love to see this. You know, just like a little breadcrumb of something good in the day. And so she came in and she introduced me to the surgeon and said, this is Dr. Weiss, and she's going to be an orthopedic resident next year. And he kind of looks up over his glasses, over the table in a southern drawl, and he says, I didn't know girls could do this. And then comes right back down to operating. And I was like, okay, I'm going home. And that was kind of my introduction to what my world was going to be. So flash forward to this moment where I got to commit to doing my fellowship with Vern Tolo and his group. And it was the year that he was president of the AAOS. For our listeners who are not familiar, that's the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. And because my dad was an orthopedist, my mom was there with me. And so I was sitting in the audience of the presidential speech where Vern was giving his speech. And he spoke about his presidential initiative was diversity in orthopedics and all the reasons that that's important. And I looked down next to me, I was sitting next to my mother, and my father was on the other side of her, and they were both crying because they, and I was like, guys, you're being really weird. It was this moment of, oh my gosh, there's a place for me. And so when I went and did my fellowship, it was an incredible academic experience. It was an incredible emotional experience. I then went and spent a little bit of extra time doing peds sports with Lyle McKaylee and Min Coker and in Boston, and then came back and joined the Children's Hospital group and stayed there for 7 years, initiated and became the director of the sports medicine program there, and then came over to Kaiser Permanente 10 years ago now.
Wow. Well, that's a real journey, really, from coast to coast of the US, isn't it? I had a look, and you obviously, at Children's Hospital, you also worked with Dave Skaggs. And, you know, when I was revising for my exam, we always learnt about crossed K-wires versus lateral K-wires for supracondylar fractures. And lo and behold, there you were, the first author. So I was very shocked because for us, it was always, oh, Dave Skagg said this. And then I looked at it, I was like, oh, it's actually Dr. Weiss, who's, you know, who was the primary author on this paper. So it was really nice to see that.
He is a tremendous research mentor. And he took me from somebody who... research was something to check off as a box of something I was supposed to do if I was going to be a good doctor. And his energy of loving research brought me to somebody who loves research. I really have to credit him for that and so much else in my life.
You're now at the Kaiser Permanente healthcare system. A lot of our listeners, especially from the UK, won't really understand what that is. Can you explain it a bit? And what does your current practice entail?
Yeah, so Kaiser Permanente is an enormous integrated healthcare system. And that's very rare in the US. There are a couple of very big ones, but Kaiser Permanente is really the gorilla. We are based, our footprint in California is the largest, and that's where I am. But there are offshoots. We are present in Hawaii, in the Pacific Northwest, even a little bit on the East Coast. So Southern California, I want to say there are upwards of 6,000 physicians in my medical group. It is a tremendously interesting place to work because of the way that we can theoretically collaborate on patient care soup to nuts rather than just touching the orthopedic portion of our patients. So my role, I kind of have a day job of being an orthopedic surgeon, and I do that 3.5 days a week, in which I do mostly pediatrics and sports within orthopedics. I do take adult call. And then the other day and a half a week, I'm administrative. And one of my roles is actually I'm on the team that leads surgical operations for our whole region. So right now, our work is very much centered around COVID, pausing the surgical work, and taking the physician workforce and offering us kind of redeployment opportunities to help out our colleagues in the ICUs and in the emergency rooms and things like that. To really try and lend some support to our physicians who are just drowning and doing so much heroic care. And that's a unique thing that we can do with this kind of integrated system.
Tell me, obviously, you touched on COVID there. How has it really affected you guys in California? I know that your state in particular has had sort of stricter protocols than most. And you know, we're at the point now where we're being vaccinated. I know you've had both doses. I've thankfully had my first dose a few days ago. Tell me, how's it all going out there?
Yeah, so Los Angeles has the dubious distinction, I think, of being the most hit in the entire country right now. We are, our ICU capacity in Los Angeles is almost at maximum. We are fairly plateaued right now. For instance, in my hospital, our capacity is we have empty beds, but we have about three times the amount of patients that we would normally be seeing in the ICU right now. What we've been doing orthopedically through, we had a surge over the spring and kind of a second surge in the early summer and then quieted down, and now this surge now. And what we've done orthopedically, we were talking before we hit record that it seems like you have a similar approach, but we have halted elective surgeries. The first wave, that was one of the reasons, was for PPE preservation. And now we're doing that for staff preservation. Our staff and our physicians are redeployed to help with the sick patients. So we right now have halted all elective surgeries. We are mostly transitioned to virtual care for our patients so that they don't have to be out in public, and really taking stock of what the patient's issues are and whether they're going to need to come in person. That's very few and far between. We're taking care of most virtually. And we're really even trying to unload and offload the primary care physicians in terms of making COVID calls. You mentioned you guys are vaccinating people. We're leaning in to do that. it's incredible in the medical community how people are leaning in these ways that make us kind of vulnerable and stressed out, at least me. But at the same time, if I weren't doing it, I'd feel terrible because there are people that are so overloaded. And so whatever skills I can harness and be taught to shift over, to unload them, to operate at their highest scope of practice, I think is really important.
And obviously, you know, now that we're sort of seizing elective services, and COVID in some ways has allowed some things to progress, like the adoption of sort of teleconferencing and virtual care, especially in the UK, where it's a national system. We've seen a huge development in that area. But our work is really going to come once everything opens up again. And, you know, how did you guys sort of work back after the first wave? I've had a huge number of patients who had their procedures delayed, were planned for this month, and unfortunately have once again been set backwards. And in pediatrics, there is that fourth dimension of time, and it can become very critical to ensure limbs are salvageable with regards to deformity and things like that. How is it affecting you guys? And what as someone who's probably involved on the administrative side, what are you doing now to help plan for that recovery?
Yeah, it's interesting. Our re-entry, as we call it, we are deep into work kind of behind closed doors on that because we want to be absolutely prepared the moment that the bell goes off that we can do it. There's a couple of things that we have in mind. Number one is having our patients prepared and the messaging to them, because we certainly hate the idea of saying, you know, yes, no, yes, no. That's just really, I think, taxing for them. So trying to stay consistent in our messaging. Trying to also, the other piece that we've been talking about that's interesting is when that time comes that it's safe for us to go back to elective surgeries, we have to remember that even as surgeons, we're going to be jazzed. We are going to be so excited to get to our patients who have been waiting for us. But we have to also keep in mind the exhaustion of the staff, and that they have been, the anesthesiologists are exhausted now and will be exhausted then. The nursing team who is redeployed from the operating rooms to the ICUs. And so trying to balance all of that and keeping patients aware that even though we can go back and that surgeons may have the energy and desire to do it, we have to balance our whole sort of workforce and keep in mind what we've just been through.
And that takes me really nicely onto our topic of wellness and burnout. I mean, burnout is truly an epidemic within this pandemic. And there were some very interesting numbers. I think there was a meta-analysis that was published recently saying that, you know, burnout affects one in two physicians over their career and costs around $4.6 billion a year. I mean, that is a huge amount of problem. And obviously, this pandemic has not helped in any way whatsoever. But what we can do is have a frank discussion as to what it is, what are the early signs, and how to tackle it. So first of all, what is burnout?
So I want to talk about burnout, and then, but I want to quickly, you've met me or you've seen me, I get edgy quickly about this. So I think burnout is very important, and I'll define it. It's a state of emotional, physical, and mental exhaustion. It's caused by excessive and prolonged stress. It happens when we feel overwhelmed, emotionally drained, and unable to meet constant demands. So that's like for every one of us going, check, 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 I got all of that. But I'm going to segue into another term that I have embraced with my edgy self, which is moral injury. And you're nodding, I know you've heard it. And if you've heard me speak, I've been talking about it for quite a while. I want to define it for people. And it's definitely a term that that had its birth in the military, and that we've now really started to use in medicine and in other places. And the term moral injury refers to an injury to an individual's moral conscience and values, and it results from an act of perceived moral transgression. And it produces profound emotional guilt and shame, and in some cases, a sense of betrayal, anger, and a profound moral disorientation. And so the burnout and the moral injury, there's so much intersection between the terms. But the thing that I think is really, the reason that I embrace the moral injury term is I look at physicians' wellness as the analogy of the canary in the coal mine. And I fully believe, and for those of your listeners that are not familiar with that analogy, the canary lives in the coal mine as a harbinger of toxicity. So if the coal mine air is bad, the canary not only stops singing, but dies. And that tells us that the workers in the coal mine are probably at risk. And so we can look at it in two ways. We can look at ways of strengthening that canary. And that's that whole conversation about resilience, which I think is great. But quite frankly, 99.9% of physicians are awesome at resilience. We were awesome at resilience before we became physicians. I love mindfulness. I love meditation. I love yoga. We are all good at those skills. We can all be a little bit better. But I believe we're not going to make any progress with this unless we look at the coal mine or the system and the toxicity that lives in it. So that's why I've gone in this edgy way of the moral injury conversation.
And obviously, you know, I think you mentioned before that it causes sort of this emotional exhaustion, this depersonalization, and this lack of personal accomplishment. And to be honest, right now, when our elective services have stopped, we lack this personal accomplishment. We enjoy seeing patients face to face. We enjoy operating. And to be told that this may not happen for 3 to 4 months is actually, it's scary. We've had conversations before in our CoronaCast episodes about how surgeons are going to feel like they need to be retrained and potentially work with a partner when we get back into this. And that's why I think, you know, I've said that our department, a few of us have trained to do vaccinations. And let me tell you, just 2 hours of vaccinations, that sense of personal accomplishment came back. I'm doing something to help fight the cause that's going to get us back to normal. So I think that was my understanding from having heard you speak before as well, that those are really the things. But how else can it manifest? How does this burnout manifest? What are the warning signs that people can look out for?
And I'm going to answer that question, but I want to say one more thing. I think what you found in your vaccinating is that sense of purpose. And there's so much data to say that if we harness a sense of purpose, we're going to do so much better than if we don't have that. So how can it manifest? Burnout can manifest very similarly to depression. We might come off as being sad or detached, boring, perhaps disengaged, grouchy, cranky, mean, and full on lacking empathy and compassion. Those are the ways that we can come off. And I think that it can become this snowball effect, because you get a little burned out, you don't connect well with the people around you, and then those people don't like you, and then they don't connect with you, and it goes on and on. It's just like watching someone fall into depression. Mm.
And obviously, you know, this we've sort of been speaking about this in the context of the pandemic, you know, where people are working longer hours, teams are being moved around, there's disorganization within the system, people are being redeployed and asked to do things that they don't normally do and may be exposed to things they're not normally exposed to, especially when it comes to life and death and treating patients, especially as PD pods, you know, who thankfully we don't see that many children suffer so badly. And, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty with regards to the vaccine, and even right now, uncertainty about the unknown future. But this, we're talking about this at the current context. But burnout has been going on for a long, long time. And I think the old guard would say that, oh, it's because we're not as good as they were, and you know, we didn't work as hard, and we probably worked less hours. And there was an article in the Royal College of Surgeons England Annals recently by a retired surgeon who made quite hefty claims of this. And I'm very grateful that the response to the editor was they had published 7 or 8 letters in response to that. But tell me, how have things changed in the last 10, 15 years in surgical training, in the healthcare system, that has led to physician wellness now being something that you yourself and your task force working with Posner have actually decided it needs to be addressed at a societal and organizational level?
Yeah. So I want to respond to what you were talking about, sort of different age groups in our profession and different seniority levels in the way we perceive burnout. And it's interesting because we polled our POSNA membership, and what we found was that although the peak of self-reported burnout was early to mid-career, it still was reported amongst our older members. And also, we asked two questions. One is, do you feel burned out? And the second is, do you think your team is burned out? And there was a higher level of reporting that the team was burned out than the individual, which is an interesting thought. And then the second piece of this is what's gone on in the last 10 years that this has kind of raised this to a societal workforce, if you will. So the history of the POSNA Wellness Task Force, which the initials, it's been changed, the name has been changed. The initials were WTF, which was very entertaining to us for quite a while. So this happened under the leadership of Rick Schwent when he was the president. He called me and he said, and he's a very thoughtful man and just a heart of gold. And he called me like kind of as if I could like have an impact on this. He said, Jen, in the US, 400 physicians per year commit suicide. And I've just done the math and that puts one POSNA member at risk every other year. That's not okay. What are we going to do? And I was like, okay, that's a tall task. And so what we did, that was, those were kind of the big why. That was the big why about this. We gathered some experts, Michael Goldberg being one of them. He is, I've known him since the day I was born, actually. He's a wonderful pediatric orthopedist. He was president of POSNA. He has been a leader in our field in both quality and now wellness. And he is a fellow at the Schwartz Center for Compassionate Care in Boston. So of course, Michael Goldberg got pulled in. Hank Chambers, who was a huge proponent of wellness and had literally, I think 2 years prior, and he's very transparent about this, he had a heart attack at IPOS. And he recovered, and just his transparency about what, you know, literally almost being lost to his stress. And then the other player that came in very early was Vish Talwalkar. And we took this proposition from Rick Schwend, and we pulled together the why. Number one was the physician suicide. But number two was understanding that the altruism of the pediatric orthopedic community probably puts us at risk. In some ways, it gives us bigger purpose, and we're, I think we are, in some ways, we expected to find that we were a happier group, but definitely more at risk to our surroundings because of this altruism. So we decided is that it was very important for our society to start to get together and understand what was our level of burnout, what was burning us out, and what we can do actionably wise. So what could we arm our members with to go back to each and every organization to say, we know that this correlates with burnout and moral injury, which in turn correlates with higher mistakes that made in patient care, correlates with lower quality care, and correlates, by the way, financially with your bottom line, because you quoted that financial implication, and you lose somebody to burnout and they don't like their organization anymore and they move, the numbers that are involved with replacing that person are tremendous. So that's what we honed in on early. And we also just enjoyed a board of directors that was so supportive of this, that this work is just continuing to skyrocket. And it's now under the leadership of Cordelia Carter, who is a powerhouse.
Obviously, there was an article in the JPO just in 2020 talking about the drivers of burnout. And part of it was, you know, there is a question of the autonomy that we have, but also the sort of management of your environment, especially with regards to the limitations of a system. Is that something that you feel has changed in the last 10 years? I mean, I know for a fact, in the UK, there is an expectation from the public to provide an excellent service, which obviously we all strive to do. But we find we're doing this with one hand tied behind our back, with, you know, we don't have a junior trainee support. We don't have secretarial support, administrative support, physiotherapists that will see patients. You know, we really do struggle somewhat. Is that something you're finding in the US? And I'm sure it varies from healthcare system to a different each hospital.
I can't say yes loudly enough. you know, and I think that the biggest driver of burnout for physicians and clinicians is to be in front of a patient, see what they need, and know you can't give it to them. So all the things that you've just pointed out. And we have this kind of workaround, which is the professionalism of physicians, to say, fine, that physical therapist is overbooked and they can't see you. Here are your exercises. You know what? You can't get a brace made. Let me see what I can do in the cast room. You know, we do these things to continue to take more and more on. And yes, that is as the administrative bloat in medicine around the world, and I know it most in the US, as we are spending dollars on administrative tasks and regulatory tasks and away from physicians connecting with patients, it absolutely contributes to this moral injury. And to me, the drivers of burnout have so much to do with all of these kind of stakes that are placed between the doctor and the patient that put at risk this kind of sacred relationship that drew us all into medicine in the first place. And so it leads to lack of respect for the physician and leads to a lack of ability for the physician and the patient to connect. And it starts with what we call them. Like, there are people that are calling patients customers and members, and, you know, what's wrong with the word patient? And there's people that are calling doctors everything but doctor. And if you Google me, you'll find my very grouchy thoughts about the word provider. But that to me is just like, why don't you just paper cut me all over my body? Why can't you use the word that we work so hard to give ourselves this title? Not so much for the vanity, although I admit I've got a big ego about that, but it has to do more with the patient getting to have the respect for my doctor. And that puts so much into our hearts and into our cups to combat moral injury.
The other part of all of this that I've sort of reflected on is, you know, there has been a surge in online reviews. And, you know, potentially litigation and complaints. It's very open. And then also, I've asked a couple of guests before about how they deal with complications, because all of these three things are contributors to burnout. Tell me, how do you manage those three things? Do you care about online reviews? Obviously, litigation is never nice to go under, and I'm sure it's more prevalent in the US than it is in the UK. And obviously, everyone has surgical complications. How do you deal with these three things?
Yeah. Okay. So first, let me hit the kind of online reviews. In my world, we interact with them as patient satisfaction scores, and I actually I find that it matters what the patients are asked. I do care if the patient is asked, "Did the doctor listen to you? Did she show you respect?" Those things, I love to get that feedback. And if I'm in a mode that I'm not able to do those things, let me know about that. But when those questionnaires include things like, how hard was it for you to park? You know, did you step in gum on the way in? Did somebody look at you sideways in the waiting room? And to detract from, as I said, kind of the sacred nature of the doctor-patient relationship, I think that there's a lot of misguided information in those patient satisfaction surveys. So I've got very mixed feelings about them. I am involved with physician communication coaching, and I think that that is a huge deal to making us feel whole and connected to our patients. However, I hate when it's considered a tool to increase patients' satisfaction. I think it is very much bastardized in that way quite a bit. The second piece is litigation and having that mode of us practicing in a defensive mode. I shouldn't say this out loud. I should knock on wood 20 million times. I've never been sued. But the best of the best have, and I probably won't get through my career without being sued. And I have been called in as a witness, as I think most physicians who have been in practice as long as I have. And just being part of that legal system and all that goes on in it and watching patients drag through it, it's just heart-wrenching. And detracts, again, from the ability to respect, you know, what we're doing and knowing that somebody's going to go back and say, you wrote on this piece of paper A, B, C, D. Did you really mean A, B, C, F? You know, and that sort of, and it creeps into the way we practice. Absolutely. The last piece that you asked was about complications. And we call those in my language, in our language, second victim syndrome. And I think, was it Mike Millis? Somebody gave a beautiful talk about second victim syndrome.
Mike Vitale.
Yes. Okay. I am part of a team. As I say these things, I'm like, how am I getting all this time to do this? But I guess these are the things that I love. I'm on a team of physician responders for second victims. And the analogy of second victim, it actually comes from that. There's a Buddhist story about the second arrow, in which the first arrow is the actual thing that hurts somebody. And the second arrow is all of the ramifications that blow out from that. And so the second victim is, I've had a complication recently with an infection and a postoperative patient. So the first victim, and victim's a tough word, but I'll use it, is the poor patient. They're the most important, right? Poor patient has an infection. And then the second victim is me lying awake at night saying, what could I do better? And everybody around me, my PA is anxious. My, you know, the nurses that are fielding questions are anxious. The infectious disease doctor, all of us that are then impacted. And I think being transparent about it, I was taught by Vern Tolo, who I like to mention at least three times per podcast. So I've got one more coming. He always said, embrace your complications. This was ahead of his time, before patients were emailing doctors, they had his cell phone number, and he used to just say, you know, lean into it. And there was a mode in the US where you were told not to apologize. And he would say, nope, absolutely. If you want to apologize, you apologize. Like, you do what you need to do to connect with that patient. And so I think it's twofold. Number one is not shunning the patient, which is so hard to do. And then giving ourselves a break and talking to our colleagues about what we're going through. And if somebody's been in practice for a minute, they've been through it.
Hmm. Well, this takes us nicely on to how do we address the problem of burnout. We've spoken a lot about the causes of burnout, you know, pre and post pandemic, but how do we address burnout, and how do we prevent it in both ourselves and our colleagues, in those who we can see are starting to show signs that this is starting to affect them?
I think it depends what stage of career we're in and what stage of burnout we're in or we're not in. For me, I will be transparent. I feel like I have been teetering on the edge, on and off of burnout, perhaps throughout my career. And it's why I became so interested in it. I think that, again, before you hit record, we were talking about work-life integration. To me, like right now, for instance, my 14-year-old daughter is aware of what we're doing here. And, you know, she's off from school today, and we have plans after we're done. But the cool thing is that I'm like, Lila, I'm going to go talk and kind of have my voice heard about the things that I care about, so that people starting their careers can know that these things are possible, that being an orthopedic surgeon is possible, even if you're cut from the cloth that I'm cut from. And, you know, you might have just seen her wandering around behind me. Like, she's full on integrated into what I'm doing. And vice versa, when I'm at work, I am not shy about talking about my kids, about saying, my phone is ringing. That is my child. Unless I'm operating or doing something emergent, I'm going to go answer that. My kids come by work pre-COVID. I take any opportunity to bring them to a conference with me if I can. I take any opportunity to be like speaking at their career day if I can. I think those things are really, really important to do and to model. And it's why my social media presence is as it is. A lot of people have said to me, you know, I've learned you're supposed to keep your social media professionally over here and personally over here. And I notice yours is all together. And I'm like, that's because I would like people to see that you can do both things, and that I'm not a bifid person with two different personas. Like, I am the same person, and at risk of oversharing my family life, that's my modus operandi. I want young women especially to see, yes, I can do yoga, have a husband, have kids, enjoy those things, and still be, I hope, a good surgeon.
And to be honest, I completely love your tweets because, they're always talking about like your daughter and your husband having fights over Christmas. It's absolutely brilliant. And it humanizes you, you know, it absolutely humanizes you, not only to, like you say, younger potential doctors, but also to your patients and to your colleagues. So, you know, my Twitter handle is, you know, @PranAB, that's my name. And I'm not planning on changing that, you know, to a doctor one. Obviously, the podcast has its own, but, you know, we always share it. But it, that's pretty much where it is. And, you know, we want people to see, you know, that I have kids, that I do go away, that I love doing certain things. And I've had patients that walk in and they're like, oh, I saw you did this on the weekend. How was it? And I'm like, oh, it was great. We were with the 3-year-old and the 6-year-old and we went to the park, but it humanizes you. And actually, as I said, being in pediatric orthopedics, we're very lucky because having kids of your own is a real bonus to helping you relate to patients and the parents as well.
And I think that we used to see this when I first started orthopedics. It was like, oh, how cool, you're a mom and you're a surgeon. And I quickly flipped that script to, well, there's lots of dads that are surgeons. And watching somebody like you light up about speaking about your kids, we're not going to fix this huge deficit of women in orthopedics until we make it a space that you can be a proud parent in as well. And so the 94% of the men playing that role is huge. In a very selfish way, I love watching that.
So another way that I've seen that we can address sort of burnout is we need to almost change our mindset and protect ourselves. I think I heard one of your co-speakers at IPOS say, you must protect the assets, which is sleep and exercise, and meticulously and relentlessly control your schedule. And to be honest, my secretary says I'm completely OCD, and that's for a reason, because that way I have control of things and I'm happier when I leave work that things are being done. But also, you know, another way of preventing burnout is to enjoy the physician-patient relationship. And I think you mentioned before the importance of connecting with your peers and colleagues in your team. Your current team, especially because you're in a niche field of sort of pediatric sports, how do you guys work together? Because it's sort of different out there. You have partners who will cover for you if you're not well. How important is that team, and what can you do to foster that supportive environment?
Yeah. First of all, I think that's Jack Flynn that has that awesome saying, and I love his approach. To me, it's this fine balance of there's the ego of I am the doctor and I'm irreplaceable, right? Versus the ability to be interchangeable to some extent, so you can have your phone off on the weekend or at night. And so to me, it's really, it's about the partners. I sent a tweet about this actually last week. 1,000,000%, the most important piece of choosing the first in any job in medicine is, will your partners lean in? Last week, I was very vocal on social media about my reaction to the second vaccine. I got hit hard with side effects to the point where I had to like physically lie in bed and go home. And I had a partner that jumped in that took care of two things for me the next day. One was washing out an infection, which is a big thing to take over. That's a postoperative complication. He took it over with grace and compassion. And the second was not an emergency at all, but a family that was worked up, a family that needed to be seen and follow up for a deformity sort of thing. And it wasn't an emergency, but they in their mind, it was an emergency. And so many partners would have said, that patient doesn't need to be seen. They can wait till Jen gets back, but not this guy. He spoke to them. He saw them. He jumped in. And that is the root of really connecting with patients. It was human. The patients were told. I let them be told that I was sick. I think that we are human and admitting that is important. And then also having the partners that are willing to compassionately jump in. And I've done it for him before and I will do it again for him. So those to me are the pieces of a structure that are did not exist 20 years ago for most practices. And I think that that is one thing that we've gotten better at.
There has been very little difference in a number of years in the percentage of female surgeons. I think you tweeted something recently that you saw, and at that stage it was 6%, and lo and behold, it remains to be 6% today. And another orthopedic podcaster, we should start calling him Ortho Podcasters, who's Dr. Nancy Yen Shipley, has a podcast entitled this, where she interviews females from who are at the peak of their specialties. And I recommend all listeners have a look at that. You yourself sit on the diversity task force of PRISM, and you've already explained why this is so important to you in helping expose the younger generation to that you can be anything you want to be. How can we level the playing field and to help aspiring female surgeons? I know that there are more of them now. I think we can see through social media that there are certainly more of them, and it may be that we're at the beginning part of that wave. But what are you involved in that helps them get along?
So first of all, Nancy's podcast, the 6%, it's called, the number 6%. It's phenomenal. Nancy and I actually brainstormed together at the beginning of that. And she is the most positive spirit in orthopedics. And she is not a pediatric orthopedist. She is in the very male-dominated field of sports medicine. So I highly recommend listening to that. She's phenomenal. To me, my strategies, Christy Weber was the first woman president of the AAOS. I've had the phenomenal fortune of having known her since I was a resident. I worked with her when I was the communications cabinet chair and she was the president. And I cannot tell you how lucky I am that I have a Zoom call with her and a group of friends every other week. So I get to pick her brain all the time. When she did her inaugural speech as president of the AAOS, she quoted, "You can't be what you can't see. And be so good that you can't be ignored." These are two pieces that have really shaped my approach. One is I let myself be out there probably far more than I otherwise would. I was, believe it or not, kind of a shy kid and even young adult. But I want people to see me and I want people to see that I'm doing this so that they know they can do it. I think that if you've read the book Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, she really talks about not being that woman who climbs the ladder and pulls it up after them. So for me, I climbed the ladder. It was a really crappy ladder. And now I've thrown down five more because I will pay it forward every chance I get. When I do pay it forward, I was speaking to a young woman who found me on social media yesterday and advising her about how to kind of start her path. And I said, and she said, "How can I thank you?" I said, "You can thank me in 15 years when you are doing what you want to do and some young woman approaches you." I think we have to do that. That kind of piecemeal approach is important. And The Perry Initiative, with that, which I think you mentioned earlier, and Nth Dimensions. These are two wide sweeping programs that connect with young people to share to young women and also to young people from underrepresented minorities that orthopedics is a field that is phenomenal. This is why we love it. And let's make it approachable. And I think that that strategy is also very important. And lastly, the group, the demographic that I have the biggest ability to reach out to because we're pediatric orthopedists are our patients. And every single time I have a young woman in my office or little girl, I ask them what they're going to be when they grow up. And if they show the slightest bit of interest, that is, I ride that like crazy. And let me tell you, if I have a young woman of color, I will ride them and ask them how their grades are and what we are going to be doing with our lives. And there's no lost opportunities around me. I do run late in clinic though.
As do I, to be perfectly honest. We both like to talk, which is also why our patients probably love us. It's also very interesting that there was a multi-center study published last year saying that one third of post-operative pediatric orthopedic patients pursue a career in medicine. I'll share the article again in the show notes, but yeah, an amazing thing to see the effect. And I actually saw Deborah Eastwood, who was our very first guest on the PD podcast, tagged by one of her patients that she treated over 20 years ago. Online with that study attached. So, you know, we do have the impact if we want to. And I think, as you said, we're in a very legitimate position to help shape the future with regards to that. Tell me a bit about the Ruth Jackson Orthopaedic Society, because I'm sure a lot of our listeners may not have heard about it. And we'll put all the Twitter links and websites in the show notes. But tell me a bit about that, because it's something that was started quite a long time ago now, but I believe has over 1,000 members.
Yes. So Ruth Jackson is a society for women in orthopedic surgery. However, you don't have to be a woman to belong. There are male members. And it is a society that works to elevate and inspire women who are in and who are inspired to be in orthopedic surgery. We have our meetings when we get to have in-person meetings. They are in conjunction with the AAOS, so they happen in the early part of the week. So if listeners are orthopedic surgeons attending AAOS, you can certainly also attend Ruth Jackson as well. The leadership is phenomenal. I was a late taker to Ruth Jackson. I thought that it was something that I didn't need, and I'm putting quotes up, and I'm fully embarrassed that that was an attitude that I had. And as I kind of became... got to do some kind of higher profile things in orthopedics, and the Ruth Jackson leadership reached out to me and they were like, Jen, we're kind of wondering why you're not a member. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. Yes. And I joined, and it is a phenomenal place to gather with people who are like me, but most importantly, to help young women coming up.
You know, you're busy with family, with work, with all these other roles, you know, with PRISM and AAOS and POSNA and all these other things. What do you do to relax and wind down and stay fit? Because obviously that's one of the things that we talk about, protecting the asset, is exercise.
Yeah. I definitely exercise almost every day. I'm a Peloton addict. I made an accountability promise to a group of women that I am in touch with via text multiple times per day that are all orthopedic surgeons. I made a commitment to them that in the month of January, I was going to run 8 miles. And I did my 8 mile run right before we came together today. I do a lot of yoga. I like to play tennis. My family stays active together. Otherwise we hurt each other. So we do a lot of hiking and biking and stuff like that. Any excuse to get up and out and around.
And you're also a member of what we call the Skeleton Crew, which is orthopedic Peloton members. We do have the handle at Peloton Pods, something that I started when I ordered mine at the beginning of the first wave. And I don't think I've ever mentioned it on this podcast before, but we now have over 350 members from all around the world. And it is really an amazing sort of community that we've developed, and people are constantly posting their rides and saying what they've done and beating their achievements. I'm currently planning to do every single day in January. I'm currently on track, so really pushing for it. But yes, if anyone here has the Peloton app or and is from one of our listeners, please join us at Peloton Pods. Tell me, we've spoken about a huge amount of things today, especially with regards to sort of integration of work life, wellness, and diversity. Where would you hope that we are as a community in 5 to 10 years' time with regards to all these things?
Yeah. Number one, I would hope that we have upped our percentage, not just of women, but underrepresented minorities in orthopedics. That's a full cycle away from now. So that's an opportunity to harness interest from people who are currently in medical school and even in college. So that's number one. Number two, I would really hope that we are at a place that we have absolutely normalized looking at systems issues and advocating for ourselves as physicians as the asset, to use Jack Flynn's term, and to make that not seem selfish and egotistical, but just to make that the norm. Those would be my two hopes. Actually, and then number three, I'm going to hope that the word provider has left the planet. And then number four, I am going to say that I hope that we have established processes to re-engage the patient-physician relationship.
Fantastic. Great answer. And finally, are there any particular books, mobile phone apps or accounts or any readings that you would recommend to our listeners as a must?
Yeah, I'm going to use visual aids.
Yeah. So while I'm on it, I've just finished reading Danielle Offrey's second book about patient communication, which is absolutely amazing as well. And highly recommend while you're grabbing a few books off the shelf. So tell us.
Gus White, Seeing Patients, phenomenal. This one everybody I think has by now, but Brené Brown, Dare to Lead. Got this as a holiday gift from one of my orthopedic friends named Melissa Cristino. It's called She Persisted, Quotes to Motivate and Inspire. And then lastly, I got this from Amy Ladd, who is a hand surgeon at Stanford. She is a giant in our field. And it's called The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse. And it's just a beautiful, whimsical book that brings back creativity. She is a ballerina and a pianist and a cultural aficionado. And she just reminds us all about the artistic aspect of our world.
Fantastic. Dr. Weiss, is there anything that I've missed? You still got to mention Vernon Tolo's name one more time.
One more time, Vern Tolo, I love you.
Well, look, thank you so much for your time. We've spoken about a huge amount of different things and covered a lot of information. I definitely recommend people look at the show notes. There's going to be a lot of links in there. Please do follow Jenna, my mom, the surgeon. Mom as in M-O-M, the surgeon. Follow us at PD Pods, and if you, as we mentioned with Peloton, at Peloton Pods. I recommend the listeners go back, and especially if they're interested in wellness, to a couple of our episodes that we did on the Corona Cast. I think that's episode 8 and episode 10. And we sort of mentioned forming a good working relationship with a team, and we interviewed Dr. Chris Turner, who's head of the Civility Saves Live movement, in episode 13 of the PD Podcast, which obviously we can be found on all major podcast platforms. And you can find us at www.pdpods.com. Jen, once again, thank you so much for your time. And I hope once this is all over and travel is open again, we get to meet face to face in person at Poznar, IPOS, AOS, PRISM, one of the many meetings that we will all be flocking to, I'm sure, once we're vaccinated and healthy.
And EPOS, and you're a superhero. Thank you for bringing this to our community.
Thank you.